First of all, David, thank you so much for taking the time out of your very full schedule to join us. Your calls have been extremely well received, as I knew they would be. I'm going to go ahead and give you a formal introduction, but I just wanted to say that one of the reasons that we wanted to invite David onto this call was that about a year ago, I had sent a cameraman to David's class to monitor his case-taking results so that we could include them as part of the homeopathic symposium. And what was amazing to discover a year later is that literally every single patient in that class is doing well. So at least for that particular group of individuals, David is batting, I guess in batting you call it 1,000%. But anyway, he's batting 100% or 1,000% with those particular people who are in his part of his class as patients. And this really gives you an indication of just the caliber of person that we have here this evening for this interview. David is just an amazing practitioner and somebody who I'm very proud to call a very, very good friend. David has been involved with classical homeopathy now and other complementary therapeutic modalities for over 25 years, and he's been a full-time homeopathic consultant for over 15 of those years. He's studied with a lot of the great masters, including people like Francisco Arzillaga, Jeremy Scher, Vega Rosenberg, and he also attended the four-year international program that was given by George Vatolkas in Alanisos, and subsequent to that, George was chosen to be the North American program coordinator for the International Academy of Classical Homeopathy in North America. David is also the founder and principal lecturer of the Hudson Valley School. That's the school I was mentioning earlier where David's batting 100%. It's called the Hudson Valley School of Classical Homeopathy, and that was established in 1996. The mission of that school is to integrate the highest understanding of the principles and theories of classical homeopathy as expounded by the masters and to apply these same laws of healing to contemporary life. If you want more information about David's program, you can contact him at 845-255-6141. That's 845-255-6141. I believe that they still are accepting students. And David, is there a website or email address that people want to contact you about the attending the school?
Yes, there is, Kim. You can contact the school at classicalhomeopathy.com.
Fantastic. Okay, great. Well, David, your last call was a huge success, and I know that we're in for a real treat tonight as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, and again, thanks to Whole Health Now and the terrific services that you supply on every level in terms of forums like this and your software radar programs and everything else. It really has made, from my point of view as a practitioner, a profound difference in what I'm able to bring to my patients and as a teacher what I'm able to share with my students. So.
Thank you for those kind words. It really is, like I said earlier, an honor to work with people like yourself. David, you had suggested the subject of emotional or physical trauma in childhood and its prominent role in the treatment of adult pathology. So I thought perhaps I would just start by asking you to define for us what you mean by emotional trauma.
Well, I'd like to start with just a very general working definition. And for our purposes, it's not complete, and many people I know who are listening have a lot of experience in the field of psychology and so on and so forth, and so this is just a general working definition, but essentially emotional trauma for our purposes is caused by a perceived event, and I want to underscore the word perceived event, on the part of the individual so that this event or circumstance or situation creates a traumatic blow to the psyche, and thus the psyche is wounded. This causative factor or a series of factors or events are strong enough to disrupt the harmonious functioning of the organism overall, and thereby, consequently, the path of harmonious and natural development of the individual is deflected, and the psyche initiates out of a sense of need, a self-defensive or protective posture. And essentially, the organism goes into some sort of level or mode of alert. And generally speaking, the greater the impact on the organism, the higher and more protracted is this alert level. Emotional trauma, I suppose, can be seen in this respect as being usually long-lasting, and directly or indirectly plays a very significant role in the rest of the person's life, impacting on a person's perception of reality and thereby shaping the nature of their relationships to the world, to their relationships with other people, and to themselves. I would also like to say that these emotional traumas, which also may be the consequence of a physical trauma, which then turn out to be an emotional trauma, they take a toll on the energetic level of an individual, and this drains some of the dynamic qualities of the vital force and has a complex series of ramifications that aren't easily discernible from preliminary observations when we first take a case. For example, they influence in a subtle way belief systems, attitudes, personal preferences. It gives us our desire for certain things and aversions, all on a very subjective level, and this level is often viewed as seemingly appropriate from an external point of view, but these machinations and these manifestations are the consequences of a perception of reality that was skewed or distorted as a result of this emotional or physical trauma. So in this way, the trauma, this working definition that we're looking at, actually is the point, or as Hahnemann might say, the etiology of pathology that pushes us off our center and causes us to have consequences, dire consequences in many instances that cause physical, mental, and emotional disease.
This is very interesting. David, can you just elaborate a little bit more about the major reasons that people become emotionally traumatized? Could you just give us a little bit more insight into that whole process?
Sure. The emotional trauma can result from a fright, a loss, a betrayal, disappointment, grief, anger, abuse, failure, all the things that happen to a human being, that these dramatic human experiences that we all have. But it's important to recognize that it's not only the quality of the actual event or the circumstances that the person is exposed to. What's equally and frequently more important is the way that that person individually receives the impressions and how they are digested. And what I mean by that is you can, given any single event, a person will receive it differently. For example, I've had the fortune in the, now it's almost 20 years of practice, of having the good fortune of working with three pairs of identical twins. And these twins, obviously, being identical, have the same environmental, familial, medical impressions in their lives, and yet they are always treated differently in terms of their pathologies. They always need different remedies at different times and frequently not the same remedies at all, in spite of being born maybe only a minute or a few minutes apart. We are all basically like crystals, and we are all cut uniquely, very much like snowflakes. And as a crystal, if there's a single ray of light shining on a group of crystals, each crystal will refract that same impression of this ray of light and refract that light in its own particular way. That's basically how we become traumatized in the way that we receive the impression. So that, as a brief example, a woman who has been, or a man who has been sexually abused, might recognize the sexual abuse later on in life as something that's horrific and traumatizing them to them to some degree, but have moved on in their lives and have forgiven the perpetrator and have seen it as just a historical fact. Whereas I can remember reading in a New York newspaper some years ago how a woman had won a lawsuit at a major stockbroking plant company, and this woman won a multi-million-dollar suit because some very inappropriate and chauvinistic pig made a comment in the copy room, and she was so traumatized by this verbal comment, which was, on the face of it, not as bad as one might have expected, although certainly obnoxious and disgusting, and she was so traumatized by this verbal comment that she actually went into a psychotic state for a period of time and needed a lot of medical treatment and various drugs to get her even functioning on the minimal level. So it's not just the event, it's how we internalize that event.
Very interesting. David, the state of the person's vital force, what effect does that have on the trauma?
Well, that's a very good question, because this goes to my response just a moment ago, that the event itself is not the only criteria for how severe we are traumatized by the event. And the state of the vital force is one of the major determining factors as to whether we take it in completely and badly, or whether we're able to transcend it and rise above it. So, for example, you have experiences of death and loss and catastrophe, and some people, and we've seen this time and time and time again, we have seen people see the same tragedy, forest fires, mudslides, where there's a natural catastrophe where many people are impacted physically, mentally, and materially on the same level, but emotionally, some are completely wiped out by their by the natural catastrophe, and others are saddened by their loss and the hardship, but they move on, they trudge on, they say, well, you know, if this is what was supposed to happen, I guess we'll have to make the best out of it. And others say, I can't move on, I've given up, there's nothing I can do, life for me is hopeless from here on in, and I have no idea what will become of my life. Two very different responses to neighbors who live side by side and watch their homes burn down. So we need to see that the vital force is the entity that will determine as to how we will actually take in, digest, absorb, assimilate, process, and hopefully resolve a traumatic experience.
Very interesting. What about the different types of emotional trauma, David? Can you elaborate on those and also help us to know where we could find them in the repertory?
Well, the different types of emotional trauma stem from a variety of events which, you know, we're all familiar with. They come from grief and anger and suppressed emotions of one sort or another, from fright, shame, fears, horror movies, if you will. It causes rage, insanity, anger, mood swings, can cause schizophrenia. But we need to recognize that these conditional states arise at the time of the events, and after the event, or built up over time, if the external event is protracted, such as shame, let's say during a phase of a child's life, they begin to put weight on for one reason or another because, let's say, there's complications at home with the parents and they don't have no place to articulate their concern, the child may put weight on and, as a consequence, be called names by their peers and develop tremendous insecurities and have poor sleep, have poor grades, and thereby have a very, very low sense of self-esteem, which would then overshadow for the reason for them to be eating and gaining weight in the first place, which are the issues regarding their parents' relationship in the household. So that can happen over a long period of time, or it can happen in an instant when when a individual is in a vulnerable state, and we'll actually be discussing this later on. I was wanting to discuss a couple of cases, and one that I have in mind is that a singular event, even though it may not be traumatized, the person was in such a vulnerable state that their guard was down and that they were in a completely trusting and open state of being, and then there was a shock to their system through one trauma or another, but not trauma in the way that we might think about it. And so little things can throw somebody off, and it doesn't have to be the horrific types of traumas that we read in the tabloids or the newspapers, how a child is abused physically, mentally, emotionally, sexually, but a little thing where the child who's developing their psyche, who's developing their view of the world, their understanding of the workings of the universe, if that's thrown off, then they have a skewed relationship with reality, and thus their relationship with their world, how they view themselves, and how they interact with others. And with regards to where we find it in the repertory, I would say that we always have to remember that if you attribute in the section ailments from, and you attribute an ailment to an emotional trauma, it's important that always, and I need to underscore that, that you can always identify the actual ailment, whether it's fright or fear or insecurity or gas or headaches or anything. But just because someone has a trauma, because we all have traumas in life, whether it's the death of your turtle or you've outgrown your bicycle or somebody cut down your tree or in the backyard, whatever it is, we all have traumas. We've always had traumas. The question is whether we can handle it. So we have to identify what the ailment is. If we go to the section ailments from, and it's a fairly comprehensive and large section now, over the years it seems to have grown ailments from. We have to find what the ailment is. Just because you suffer a loss doesn't mean you have a consequence to that. We need to find the consequential impact after the trauma. And so if you suffered a loss or a grief or a horrific event, that's one thing. Depending on how the person relates to that and the consequences that ensue from that as the etiology, those are the ailments from. The woman, I think I spoke last time, who had headaches for 20 years, and I found out in the interview that she got married 20 years ago, and I was very elated and felt, aha, you know, it's the marriage that's lousy. And I questioned her about her relationship with her husband, and she said, it's a wonderful relationship with her husband. And I was dismayed. I said, 20 years ago, there's an etiology. 20 years ago, she gets married. 20 years ago, she has headaches. And then I explored further, and she began a job at the same time that she got married, and she hated her boss. And her boss made her so insecure and so frightened that he pushed her into a staff sacred state where she suppressed all her anger because he was psychologically and sexually inappropriate with her in terms of his language and his body behavior and so forth. But she held it in and she suppressed it. And for 20 years, she had headaches. And as soon as I gave her the staff sacred, she told him, this is not a little translation, but she told him to take a hike, and she quit her job, and she left the security of the job because she wanted to be free of the abuse. And these are the things we need to look at. We need to see the migraine headache or the gastrointestinal problems, if there is an etiology and if there is an ailment from. So, for example, in our time, you know, Mr. Bojangles has a dog for 15 years, but 20 years later, he's still grieving. So maybe he needs Napier or Ignatia, I'm not sure. But the bereavement groups that we have today in the communities, these are people who have not transcended or healed or resolved in a natural, organic way the time that's allotted to a human being, the time that's required to heal from an emotional wound. There are certain periods of time where people can digest and acknowledge and honor a loss, but there are those who get stuck in loss or in grief or in horror. They get stuck, and then they can't get out of that. And so they turn to either therapies or drugs or whether prescription or recreational or alcohol, it's all basically the same. They resort to a whole bunch of other behaviors, whether it's gambling or fighting or you know, bungee jumping or jumping out of airplanes, just to make them feel more alive. And they do this in order to accommodate their disability, which they can't transcend. And at the same time, I mean, they move on as best as they can in their lives, as we have in our instances tried to move on through the traumas of our lives.
Very interesting. David, I know that working with children sometimes poses an even more difficult situation, you know, when dealing with traumatized kids. Are there things in particular that a homeopath or parent needs to look for when a child has become traumatized?
Yes. You know, Kim, in our culture, we like to think that the professionals can deal with any issue, you know. And it used to be that, you know, if you had a horse, you basically took care of it on your own, and only in dire emergencies did you get a vet. But now we have cars, we can't even have access to them. We always call on the professionals. And the professionals can't always fix simple trauma. I mean, if there's a death, now we have books on bereavement for children of various types, depending on various religious models and paradigms. But what about a sense of lower self-esteem? How do we assess that? And the one thing with children that's easier in a way, especially young children, that's easier in a way than with adults is the less ego that a child has, the easier it is to assess if they're more directly affected by something that's traumatic for them. We had a case in class just this past weekend and assessed that a woman who has partial spinal cord incapacity as a result of a car accident stemmed from the fact that she made a move from one part of New York State to another part of New York State. And because that move was so traumatic, not only in terms of her moving away from her friends and the familiarity of her environment, but that it changed the course and the stability of her parents' relationship so that it became a very difficult and volatile relationship, whereas before it was not, that her older siblings seemed to find a new way to relate to the world because they moved from a fairly populated community to the boondocks, basically, where the father tried to fulfill his dream for raising horses, but there was no one around, so the brother and sister, who was older than this particular patient, learned to drive early and was out of the house most of the time. So having had a family ripped out from under her, and not having her friends, and not having a way to socialize, she became more and more introverted and depressed, and nobody saw it. And we need to be attentive to just changes in the general mood or temperament of a child, to look for mood swings. These would in turn change the biochemistry. And so that change in biochemistry might create either cravings or aversions for certain foods, just as a chemical reaction from an emotional change. The same thing would happen with regard to normal functioning, bowel movements, sleeping patterns, quality or different types of dreams, states of settled apathy or indifference. You know, a child may have always liked to do something, and then something slightly traumatizing happens. And ever since a certain period of time, and they never talked about it, something in school or whatever, they stopped enjoying ice cream. And they loved ice cream and they loved sweets. And they've always wanted sweets and ice cream and drinks and cakes. And suddenly they all they do is stomp around and say, it's just not fair. It's just not fair. And you think about someone who wanted all those sweets and suddenly has this indignation. And, you know, you think of something that happened to them where there's some sort of unfortunate event that they consider unfair and a great injustice. And they lose their taste for sweetness, and that gets replaced by bitter things in their emotional life. And you might think of Costco losing their taste for the sweets. And it may be an event that's very slight. Maybe they expected to be given an honor at some point, you know, in the Boy Scouts or the Brownies or whatever, and something was denied them. It doesn't have to be a huge, horrific event. It may have just be that a child had tremendous expectations at a vulnerable time in their life, and they experience a tremendous disappointment. And that disappointment is enough to create a whole pathology. We have ailments from rudeness, ailments from being scorned, ailments from disappointments, all these things. How many times have we been disappointed in our lives, all of us? And yet, in some cases, these ailments from disappointment turn out to be a pathology later on in life, a real pathology, a life-threatening pathology. And as I said, perhaps in a little while we can discuss some cases where this comes up from small things, not from the huge, monstrous, horrific things, but from small things.
David, you've been putting a lot of emphasis on the fact that, you know, people get traumatized all the time, but that, you know, it really, really matters on how we respond to that trauma. So I was curious, are there different ways that people internalize and digest their trauma, and could you give us some insight into that whole process?
Well, there seem to be several obvious ones, and, you know, as I'm sure for people who are listening who have had firsthand experience in psychology or studied psychology, there are the ones that we need to look for example, that try to compensate for the trauma, because the vital force is always looking for equilibrium and trying to maintain homeostasis. And this is, of course, in compliance with, you know, cosmic law. Otherwise, all the planets would be constantly banging into one another. So when they go into some sort of alert and try to return to a state of equilibrium, they often do so, first of all, by going to a state of denial. What? By pretending that the event didn't happen, or they rationalize it, and that the events of the traumatic situation isn't as bad as it might seem. And in a way, you know, the great Russian author Dostoevsky wrote in one of his novels that I like very much, he writes, "I'm amazed how we deceive ourselves by putting reason on our side." And we do that, you know, oh, it's not so bad, or it will be better, or whatever. And I had a patient actually today, I'm calling, speaking to you from not my home office, but my office in New York City. A patient came in today, and she started a whole line of products, and quit her job and ended a relationship that was unhealthy for her for many years. And someone took advantage of her, in a business way, just as her father had taken advantage of her when she was younger. And this is actually a cycle that's gone on for many years. And the first remedy I gave her was a snake remedy. And now the same type of event occurred 6 or 7 years after she started treatment with me here, and she needs another snake remedy. But it's a very parallel experience. And it's very interesting how another snake remedy came up for that kind of constriction and paralysis in her life. But she handled it better than the first time I gave her the remedy. But we get thrown off our centers, so we go into denial. And we also go into states of detachment. We separate from ourselves. We suppress our emotional states more often than not. And what happens is we become less emotional in general. And this leads, and it's quite common, leads a person to think about what they feel rather than feeling their feelings. And this transference from the feeling center, which has been wounded, over to the thinking center of rationality, permits easy access to functioning in society in general, because we don't have to, at our jobs, reveal our deeper emotional states. But this moving, this transference from our emotional feeling to our thinking feeling state causes stilted and dissatisfying personal relationships with others and for themselves in general in terms of their fulfillment and what they wish to fulfill in terms of their purpose and the meaning of their own lives.
David, you know, one of the things that I know this is a very large question and there's a lot you could say about it, but it just, you know, we've been touching on it a little bit, and I'm curious, from your point of view, how does an emotional trauma in childhood impact a person's life as they grow older, and what role does homeopathy have in all of that?
Well, you're not asking me the easy ones today, are you?
Well, you can take any part of that if you want.
Well, you know, it's just a thumbnail sketch. This is what we do in my classes. You know, we try to really understand things in depth, but I'll take a stab at it. I'd say that any emotional trauma that a person sustains, whether it's an immediate trauma that hits them and knocks them down immediately, or something that is protracted and happens over time, but in either case, when there's an emotional trauma that's permanent, insofar as is that it remains unresolved in the organism, it has to compensate for that imbalance through either artificial, chemical, or even ingenious means, because it throws the person out of sync and harmony toward their ultimate fulfillment of their lives. You know, in paragraph 9, Hahnemann refers to the harmonious relationship between centers and how the relations function in admirable, harmonious relation in regards to sensation and function. And when this is thrown off, the person has to compensate. And it happens on the emotional plane exactly as it happens on the physical plane. If you injure your leg, in order to move through life, you'll limp if you have to. Even if the bone is not set correctly, you will limp because you need to move on with your life. And psychologically, there's a whole lot of people limping around, except we don't see that on the psychological level. In the best case scenario, I suppose, Kim, an individual can transcend that trauma and use it to their advantage. But in my experience, this is very rare, and that road is very arduous because it generally involves a certain kind of higher teaching that they're involved with. And in the worst case scenarios, people are frustrated, they feel unfulfilled, hopeless, despairing, physically ill, even with life-threatening diseases. They're emotionally inept, which is why men can't commit in this culture. Mentally incompetent, which is why more people from other countries of the world work in the Silicon Valley, producing the toys and technological needs for this nation, than we can fulfill with our own indigenous population. We have become mentally impaired through our pathology as a culture. We have to import people to compensate for that. And we're also spiritually bereft. And T.S. Eliot wrote in a poem called The Love of Alfred J. Prufrock. He writes that people live their lives in quiet desperation. And we know there are a whole host of songs regarding this. And these are the people who, if they have a home, still feel hopeless, and they become mildly sociopathic and disenfranchised from society and from themselves and alienated. They can become religious fanatics and rigid dogmatists and prejudiced and narrow-thinking, self-appointed pseudo-heroes of their own delusions. And they impose their view of reality on everyone they meet through their dogmatism, through their fanaticism. And it doesn't have to be profound dogmatism or profoundly entrenched in terms of hitting someone over the head, but subtle. You know, we see this in our advertising daily. There was an advertisement for high-speed internet about 5 or 6 months ago on the radio, and it said it was all kids making a statement as to why they liked high-speed internet. And one child said, well, I can get the facts for my homework faster. And another child said, I can play more. And one child said, well, I used to go to Billy's house. Billy was my best friend, but he didn't have high-speed internet, so I don't go play with Billy anymore. and it was a legitimate commercial, because what it says is, if you don't have the right toy, friendship has no real validity any longer. And that becomes negotiable. Friendship, essence, meaning, has to do with how fast you can download information for a silly game. These become the morals and the values of our culture, and I believe they're unhealthy. I believe that this is the pathology. And the members of this culture are not the ones to be found in the psychiatric institutions, but they're some of our friends, some of our family members, and our co-workers, and community, and governmental officials, and religious leaders, and the like. So the subtlety of the pathology is not obvious in the culture. And this subtlety, as it permeates the culture, impacts on people's lives so that we become more and more dysfunctional as we function in the culture.
Very interesting. David, you had mentioned that you wanted to talk about some cases. So I was curious, could you give us an example or two of some cases that you've cured where there was a direct relationship between childhood or adolescent trauma and some manifestation of that as a disease in the adult person's life?
Yeah, I would, because it comes up as some very interesting cases where the subtlety of the trauma is ripped. And I went through my files, and I chose three cases. If we're running out of time, I'll cover as many as I can, but I chose three to highlight it. The first is a woman who had breast cancer, 42 years old. The cancer was present in both breasts, but not yet very actively metastasized. One thing about the woman was that her behavior was strange insofar as she did everything in a distorted kind of fashion. For example, for reasons that you'll understand in a few moments, she had tremendous suspiciousness and distrust for her parents because of the event that I'll explain shortly. And as a consequence of that, she wanted to punish them. So given that her parents were of a certain religious faith, she married a man when she was 18 years old who was not of her faith and thought that this would really get back and punish her parents. And much to her chagrin, her parents met this man who she married, and they fell in love with him. And they thought he was the nicest guy in the world, and they changed their prejudices about this other ethnic and religious group. And what did this woman do? She divorced him. And she divorced him because she couldn't punish her parents. Then she decided that she wanted to become a midwife. So she did become a midwife. And then she took all her skills of midwifery And she decided that she would practice the skills of midwifery and become a midwife to pigs in Nicaragua. And she went down and she became a midwife to pigs and other farm animals in a South American country. And she also had a child out of wedlock with another man out of her faith, but her parents liked him too. She always chose really nice men, much to her chagrin because she wanted to get back at her parents. But she had a child out of wedlock, and her child was very cool and very tall and very beautiful and very, very popular and just a wonderful, wonderful child. And on her, when she started to have her menses, her menage, the mother, this patient of mine, had a menses party for her. An event that goes back to the, you know, generations ago, and embarrassed her daughter terribly. It was a surprise menses party. But the mother thought it was a very sacred thing, and it is. But according to the will and the way that her child grew up, it was a tremendous embarrassment. And the woman also wanted to buy some land and wanted to invest in a beautiful estate. But the estate was in complete shambles and disrepair. And if she invested in the estate, she would have had no money to fix it up and she would have gone bankrupt. And all these things were distortions of her reality. So I ended up treating her for her distortion of reality. And what happened was that the distortion of the reality came about from an event. First, I gave remedies for the breast cancer. And within 4 months, there was movement toward improvement. Within a year, the breast cancer was cured. No sign of it at all. Complete remission. But her distortion of reality still persisted. And my perception was, this case is not cured. The cancer is gone, but the distortion still persists. And unless I got to the distortion, there could be no resolution to her physical disease. And it came about that when she was 6 years old, she had her emotional trauma, her crisis. And what happened was she and her family had gone to Fort Ticonderoga in New York to participate in the pageantry of 4th of July celebration there. And she was 6 years old. She was not so interested in the pageantry of, you know, colonial soldiers and so on and so forth. So she tugged on her father's jacket and said, "Daddy, I'm going to go to the car," which was down the ramparts in this huge parking lot field. And she said that his response to this request was, "Fine, go right ahead." And so she went down the ramparts and left the pageantry where the fort was and found the car and was picking daisies and sitting on the car hood, and everything was fine. And she was having a good time in the sunlight and being by herself, and she heard some screams, and she looked up and she saw her parents running down the ramparts, screaming and waving their arms, and they got closer and closer and louder, and they finally got up to her, and they said, "Where were you? Why did you leave? We were so worried. You know you're not supposed to do that." And then, as she's relaying the story to me, her voice literally broke into a little child's voice, and these are the words that she said, and this is a quote. She said, "I thought I did everything a little girl was supposed to do. I thought I knew the right way to do things." And she repeated this phrase about 10 times in this little wispy girl's voice. "I thought I did everything a little girl was supposed to do. I thought I knew the right way to do things." And then she just sobbed in my office for 15 or 20 minutes, just sobbed deeply, profoundly, and I gave her a remedy, not Ignatia and not Napier and not the things you think of grief, but that things are distorted. And within 3 months, she went out and bought a nice, smart little ranch house with a white picket fence that needed no work, Within a year, she got married to a man who she loved, who, whether she didn't care whether her parents liked or didn't like, she just loved him. She resolved her relationship with her daughter, who really never had forgiven her for throwing the party. And this case was about 12 years ago, and I haven't seen the patient for 7 years, and there's been no relapse of the cancer or any other life-threatening disease for 7 years. So that's case number one.
Dave, you going to tell everyone what remedy it was?
I'm sorry?
You going to tell us what remedy it was that you gave?
Oh, no, of course not.
Okay. All right, go ahead. We don't have too much time, so...
Okay. Well, let me just...
Why don't you do one more case?
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll make it fast. I just wanted to say that just this perception of reality that was twisted because she thought she did the right things and her parents claimed that she didn't, threw her whole life off. And that's what happened. Anyway, the remedy was argentum nitricum.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So there's another woman who's in her mid-50s, and this case also about 15 years ago, with GI problems, chronic migraines, chronic skeletal and muscular pain, but very, very quiet, very petite, vegetarian, lots of physical complaints, as I've said. And she, her problem was resolved over time. All the physical stuff was gone with about a year, 14 months, and she came in and I said, "And how are you feeling?" And because all her presenting symptoms were resolved, and she said, "Oh, I'm feeling so much better. Life is wonderful." I said, "Do you think there's anything else? Because I don't see anything else." She said, "Well, you know, there's just one little thing." And she always spoke in a whispered voice, very quiet, very hushed. And I said, "Well, you know, let's do a little bit of fishing and see what happens." And I said, "Well, how's your diet?" She said, "Oh, you know, I'm a vegetarian, and it's very healthy, and I've been vegetarian for many years." I said, "How about your relationship with your husband?" "Well, my husband is a Zen monk and a scholar, and, you know, my relationship with him is wonderful." I said, "How is it where you work?" She worked as a nurse on the terminal ward. She said, "Well, somebody has to do it, and, you know, I know I'm not going to, these people will never be cured, but I hope to be part of the healing process as they make their transition." And I said, "Well, how about your relationship with the other nurses?" And she sort of stood up in her chair and gave me the scowl. And when I said, "How are the girls that you work with?" And I hope I don't blow everybody's eardrums out, but this little petite woman said, "Those bitches!" And you know, she knocked me out of my chair. And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Those scheming little bitches." I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "They're the worst, all women." And it turns out that at 52 years old, she hadn't had a girlfriend for 40 years. And the long and short of it is, when she was 13 years old, she lived in a large Victorian house, and her favorite aunt came up to visit the house and her family. And what happened was, she didn't know when her aunt would be coming, but she was just admiring a 13-year-old budding body in this 6-foot mirror. So rather than putting on a robe as her aunt came up the stairs, she struck a pose, butt naked, and she's standing there, and her very favorite and curvaceous and gorgeous aunt came in, walked around her 3 times, looked her straight in the eye and said, "Honey, you'll never have the right stuff," and walked out. And that moment of vulnerability turned into betrayal and hatred. And I ended up giving her pulsatilla 200C, one dose. And in 3 weeks, she had the mother of all colds. And 6 weeks later, she came back and I said, "How are you doing?" She said, "Oh, I feel wonderful. It was a horrible cold." I said, "How's work?" "That's great. Do you feel anything's wrong?" "No." I said, "How are the girls on the ward?" She said, "Well, they've all changed. They're all so wonderful now. Every time I see them now, I give them a hug. I even had a party for them last week." That case was cured 9 years ago, and she's had no recurrence of anything in the last 9 years. So there are cases that we can take and cure the person. This gives support to curing the person, not the disease. and we can find that the etiology, the origins for the cure need to be found in unresolved emotional trauma.
Very interesting, David. I see we're kind of running out of time, so let me just ask
right.
one more question. You know, we'll have to hopefully bring you back on again because you've got so much valuable stuff to share, and I know it really is, you know, coming from your own real clinical experience working with patients over all these years, so I know it's invaluable information. You know, I just thought I would ask you as a final question. You know, we treat all these people who've had, you know, tons of traumas during their childhood. In your experience, can homeopathy completely eliminate the pathological consequences of these early childhood traumas? Or what is your own experience with this? I mean, what level of success have you achieved working with emotional traumas once you're working with an adult?
I think, Kim, that for the most part, the majority, and it's hard to say what part of that majority, but I feel, at least in my experience, the majority of severe consequences can be eliminated. Sometimes you have to scrape away. Most often you have to get through the presenting symptoms, the presenting diseases to get to the problem. But if you dig long enough, hard enough, and you're accurate, you can get rid of that emotional festering wound and allow it to finally heal, bring about resolution in the person's life, and it will always remain a scar, but the scar doesn't have to be traumatic. It could just be a reminder of an event in a person's life that was unfortunate for whatever reason or other, but you can cure, and you can bring resolution, and it's my experience to be part of that, and it's a joyful thing to really see, because not only do you cure the person of the disease that they're suffering from in the presenting symptoms and the intake, but you cure them of diseases that they would have had down the road, and the quality of life is changed and enhanced forever. And it's a remarkable part of being part of the healing community to participate in that. It's an honor, and it's humbling, but it's joyful at the same time.
Well, David, thank you again. That was a very informative, wonderful discussion of a very important issue in homeopathic practice. Let me just remind people, for those of you who joined us a little bit later or didn't get the information down, that you can study with David in upstate New York, and the contact number to get more information is 845-255-6141. That's 845-255-6141. And the email address is, David?
It's classicalhomeopathy.com.
Classicalhomeopathy.com?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't sound quite right.
I'm technologically challenged.
Okay. Let me see if I can find it while we're talking. I think it should be up on our website. But anyway, you can call him at 845-255-6141. And if you haven't had an opportunity to study with David personally, I can't recommend it highly enough. I mean, David is somebody who really gets the results. You know, he really, the proof is in the pudding, as I like to say. And David's the person who you can go and study with and actually learn how to successfully practice homeopathy. So if you have an opportunity and you're anywhere in the New York State area, I can't recommend it highly enough. I think the people who I know who've studied with him have only waxed poetic about how wonderful his teaching and his ability to impart homeopathic knowledge to his students is. The email address for those of you who'd like it is homeopath, H-O-M-E-O-P-A-T-H, and then the number 4@AOL.com. And hopefully that's still correct. The phone number again is...
It's actually earthlink.net.
Okay, so it's homeopathy4@earthlink.net. So homeopath4@earthlink.net. And the phone number again is 845-255-6141. So let me go ahead now. We don't have too much time, but let's ask have a couple of questions. So anybody have a question they'd like to ask? Hello, this is your golden opportunity. I know, Krishna, you're on the phone. Anybody have any questions that they'd like to ask?
I think I traumatized everybody.
It was a good...
I think you had a wonderful talk.
It was excellent.
Yeah.
It was absolutely brilliant.
Here's a question.
Go ahead. Somebody ask a question then.
All right. What percentage of cases do have a distinct etiology? I mean, you know, it's kind of a such a broad question, maybe unanswerable, but what percentage of an average, in an average practice, would an etiology be the key to finding the remedy?
I think in the American population that I treated, it would be probably not less than 75%. In Europeans and people from third world countries, it would be less than that. But in Americans, I find about 75% or maybe even more have their physical pathology as a direct consequence from an unresolved emotional trauma or series of traumas earlier on in their lives.
David, I'm curious, what is the reason for, or what do you speculate is the reason to the higher percentage in your experience in North America as opposed to Europe in terms of etiologies being emotionally trauma-based?
I think there's less attention to children and to the human dynamic. We spend less time conversing at dinner. We spend less time being with our children. We're not really in touch. I mean, how many times have we heard of teenage suicide and the parents said, I had no idea. Johnny gave us no clue that anything was bothering him. I find that impossible to believe.
Sure.
So I think it's a lack of sensitivity toward ourselves. It's not that we love our children less. It's that we've just become alienated and estranged from our own emotions and therefore can't recognize danger signs in our children.
All right, let's have one more question.
Can I ask a question?
Lotta, go ahead.
Thank you. Your definition of emotional, like childhood trauma, have you gotten that information from your own practice, or are there any books that you might recommend, or did you do Landmark Forum? Because it sounds, it's just incredible, and I'd just be interested in finding out some of your sources for understanding the fact that it is perceived and not actually a threat at that time.
Right. No, this is from my own experience, and I am working on a text defining various aspects of homeopathy, given the subtle nature and nuances that we need to have as tools in order to discern illness. So this working definition is my own, and it's going to be incorporated into a work that I'm currently involved with called Fears, Impulse, and Desires, the consequential aspects of human interaction. So that'll be out one of these years. I don't know, but if you contact me, I'll be happy to send you something on hard copy if you'd like to get that for your own edification or whatever.
David, thank you so much. I'm going to unmute and let everyone thank you personally, but really, it's such a pleasure to have you join us for these calls. I can't tell you how rewarding the experience is for everybody. Hold on.
David, where do you practice?
Yep, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. It was fabulous.
Did I ask you one? Where does David practice?
Upstate New York.
Upstate where? Syracuse?
Upstate New York. New York. I have an office upstate New York, New York City, and also out on Long Island.
Where in New York City is the information on your website?
If you contact us, we'll get back to you. It's in Manhattan.
Great. Thank you very much.
I have the phone number, the 845-255-6141. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on the call. Have a nice evening.